This is Andrew Middleton from Sheffield Hallam University's Learning, Teaching and Assessment in Higher Education podcast. Following on from the previous episode where I discussed Facebook with Vic Whittaker, in this episode I'm speaking with Sue Jameson-Powell about her research project on social networking. Sue is a postgraduate researcher in psychology, and so her perspective is less about educational applications of social networking technologies and more to do with the types of relationships each of us have. Do you want to explain why you have an interest in social networking and social networking technologies?
I come from sort of the background of psychology, and I'm looking at social networks from an evolutionary psychology. I'm part of a research group that joins Hallam University with Manchester and Liverpool University, and we're all looking at different types of social networks in connection with technology.
So I know you've got an interest in technologies like MySpace and Facebook. Does your network of fellow researchers have a group in any of those environments?
No, we don't actually.
That's abysmal.
It would be a rather good idea, wouldn't it? Yes, I should set one up. There's lots of researchers that are using these to network. I've made quite a few contacts through things like MySpace and LiveJournal.
That's a blog, isn't it?
It is. It's a blog and website, but I'd argue that it's very, very social, where things like WordPress and Blogspot, they tend to be used more by people who are publishing onto the internet, where LiveJournal has a very strong social element with sort of threaded discussions.
So you've got an interest in applications like MySpace and Facebook because you believe by focusing on those that you can learn about other social networks. Have I got that right?
Yes, yeah, I think so. Obviously, there's going to be huge differences between people who socialise through MySpace and Facebook and people who socialise offline. But the processes are quite visible with people who are socialising online. You can see all the interactions, and also there's very little room for blurring for intention with meanings like tone of voice and things like that, because it's all text and everything like that. So it's very easy to sort of read people's behaviour that way.
And before, when we were chatting, you were talking about the ethical considerations of using these tools, and you were saying that ethically, from a research point of view, those environments provide a much more controlled and useful environment for you.
Well, especially if you look at, take example, MySpace, most people have a public profile, but you can make yours private, I think, if you're under 16. But so you see all the interactions people have, and it's publicly available. So there's no bias in any information by observing it. Sort of that effect that researchers have. And you don't have to sort of ask permission, really, to use the data, because it's out in the public domain.
I mean, do you think there's a change in the way people are behaving and their readiness to be more open?
Oh, definitely. I think half the problem is people don't appreciate how public the information that they give is. I've read a couple of studies recently about people's perception of how public the information is and how public it really is, and people have been quite shocked by the difference. I know, for instance, some people have lost their jobs for criticising employers through sites like LiveJournal, and they don't appreciate that everything that they put in the public domain can be read by anybody with a computer.
The motivation for people in setting up an online presence, an online profile, I would imagine, I don't know whether you've found any evidence for this, I could see an academic using something like Facebook because they wanted to promote their research, mm-hmm. and to develop a community, mm-hmm. a social network around, you know, the focus of their work.
Definitely.
However, the social networks aren't exclusive to aspects of people's lives. If you're online, you're online as a professional, as a friend, as a community, in every aspect of your life, you are opening yourself up and your profile, mm-hmm. to all sorts of people, family, friends, and colleagues. So it's kind of bizarre, isn't it, that we're doing this?
It is. Dana or Dana Boyd is a social network researcher in America, and she just recently published some research about teenagers who would have multiple profiles because they're having they're showing different aspects of their personality. So that sort of thing does happen, but I think it's quite rare, especially for academics and for people perhaps who don't have enough time to use the internet all the time to access the different facets of their personality.
So she is suggesting that people are setting up different, creating different
teenagers
profiles.
Teenagers mainly, this is. Her work, I think, centres on how teenagers use social networking sites. Yeah, they'll have completely different email addresses, completely different profiles for a profile for them as a sports fan, profile for them as a music fan, and they won't diverge from each profile. They won't combine them at all.
So it sounds as though some sus people then are realising that they need to start managing their online presence a bit more.
And you get, there's the old, it's like an analogy with a false diary that you keep for your parents for them to read.
And
some teenagers will have a false profile that they'll let their parents see, but then they will have a real one that they sort of, that's really them, and that's where they talk to their friends.
I've heard of some bizarre stories about some of the so-called people and profiles up there on sites. I was aware of a story where someone died, a young person died, and their friends used, I think it was probably Facebook, to create a profile and to network to that online presence as a way of remembering that, you know, their friend.
Yeah.
And I think, if I'm correct, what happened there was that, of course, the close friendship, real life friendship network, set up this memorial and linked into it as friends. But then condolences started to appear from people right across the whole world. They wanted to express their sympathy. So it's kind of bizarre, really, isn't it?
It is. There was something, I don't know if it's the same one, but similar to that, where a person died, and at the funeral, the details of the funeral were posted, and thousands of people turned up that had never actually met the person, but they communicated with them online. So it does make strong ties. It does. Social networking does make a sort of difference to people's lives.
We talk about social networking tools as being distinct from real life, but where it gets really interesting is where it's not so distinct, and where indeed the online tools feed into and affect real life itself.
I keep an account on LiveJournal, and I have a lot of people on there who I've met in real life, and I communicate on LiveJournal. But when I see them in real life, I find I don't have anything to speak to them about, because I know what's going on in their lives, they know what's going on in my life, and so we don't really communicate. So we could be in a room and sort of wave and smile at each other, and we look like we're not very good acquaintances, and not even friends, but we do know a lot about each other, and we're quite intimate online. So, and then there's the other difference, where I will be quite good friends with someone in real life, but I won't add them to my live journal because we don't have any sort of interests that we could share online.
One can complement the other, real life and virtual life. But at the same time, we're saying that real life sometimes works better when it's just real life, and virtual friendships work better when they're just virtual friendships.
You could translate that to offline, where you would perhaps play football with someone week in, week out, you're very good teammates, and then you will decide to go, well, perhaps a bad analogy this, but go to the pub, and you have nothing to speak to each other about there, because it's sort of a task-focused relationship you have. I think if you try and create a social network where there wouldn't be one offline, you might run into problems.
And maybe in many ways it's no different to other forms of social networks that we have. I mean, my friends don't tend to mix with the people who I work with. It's not that I don't like the people who I work with. I really like the people I work with. But it's some, we have an understanding in the real world, don't we? That, you know, when I go to work, it's generally work, and, you know, when I'm not at work, I'm meeting other people and my family, you know.
And don't forget, you often, well, you do adapt your behaviour to the people that you're around. So you will behave differently at work as you will do with your friends. And if the two are meeting, it's a bit hard to know how to behave. And if then your friends are meeting your work colleagues, the line blurs again there. It's like your work colleagues become your friends now, and it is a tricky thing.
Mm.
I've recently had one of my students added me to the Facebook, and I've not actually had to do that because I don't know whether or not I want that level of sort of intimacy. You could argue that it's intimacy with someone that, you know, at the end of the day, I'll be marking essays and things like that. So there is sort of the ethical things that way as well.
Well, you won't have heard it, but in the previous conversation I had on social networking, exactly the same point was made. And both Vic and I, in that conversation, found that independently we've been invited by students to be their friends. And that in there were a couple of cases where these students were young women, and the photographs that they chose to represent themselves were photographs targeted probably at very close friends, possibly intimate friends, and really challenged the professional relationship that Vic felt he had with his students. So ethically, there are some dilemmas for us.
I suppose the rule of thumb you could use is if you would socialise with them in real life, if you would meet them down the pub and go for a drink, and you feel happy enough doing that, then there shouldn't be a problem adding them to your online life. But it's whether or not you feel ethically, morally happy with doing that. We've talked about earlier about ownership of whether a university can control if they have a MySpace page or a MySpace discussion group or anything like that, that they can affect a control of that they would have if they had an in-house system. There's a danger that you'll get this sort of Wikipedia effect, which Wikipedia is fantastic, load of knowledge there. Mm. It's come from all over the world, people are inputting this, and it's huge. But there is, you have to check, because just because it's on Wikipedia doesn't mean it's correct, and there could be the same effect with discussion groups that you might have on MySpace, that somebody could come with this sounds like a great idea and this brilliant article that they've researched, and without the sort of control checking up, it could completely be wrong. And
Exactly. I think this is one of the things that's coming out of it for education, that there are all sorts of opportunities, and Wikipedia is the classic one that often gets mentioned. But we know that there are risks with these new opportunities, and for Wikipedia, it helps us to realise that more than ever, our students have to learn about evaluation of the sources they use. And that's interesting, because, you know, in that case we're talking about evaluation of content, of written down information.
Yeah.
But what you're suggesting is we also have to learn to discriminate and evaluate.
Yeah.
The friendship networks that we draw upon.
The people who are on there may not be who they say they are. With the profile, you can say most people actually are quite truthful, especially when they're adding real-life friends, because if their profile says they're somebody they're not and they had a real-life friend, they're immediately going to be sort of caught out on that. But you can say you could anybody on your profile. You can change gender, you can add, take away 50 years to your life.
Okay, having highlighted a few of the risks and the need to evaluate sources of information, just coming back to some of the opportunities, I listen, obviously, well, maybe not obviously, but I listen to an awful lot of podcasts. I have come across people and voices and opinions using a social technology, and I call it a social technology, like podcasting, voices that I would have never encountered, that aren't from the university where I'm based.
Mm-hmm.
They're global voices. They're thinking as they speak, so they're very free ideas. And I think there's a great opportunity in technologies like podcasting and the social networking tools to encounter and then evaluate ideas that you would never have had a chance to work with before as a student.
That's a really good point. One of the dangers of the internet is that you end up speaking to other people that are exactly like you, but if you make the leap and step outside that group, you're getting opinions that are directly opposed to yours, but it does open up your mind and make you think about things from different directions. So, yeah, sort of the podcast effect that you've mentioned is a really good point.
Great. I could go on talking about these things, but thanks very much for that. But it's really, really interesting. I hope you found that conversation interesting. I know I have at least one more related interview in the can, and in the spirit of social podcasting, I would invite you to send me your thoughts on this subject, or perhaps you would like to take part in a discussion. Please feel free to get in touch and share your ideas with me. You can contact me by email at lta-podcast@shu.ac.uk, or you can become my friend on Facebook or MySpace or elg.net. That's elg.net. Or you can leave me a comment or some audio feedback on the show notes website at http://ltapodcast.blogspot.com. I would love to get some voices onto the next podcast on this subject. So basically plug a microphone into your computer and go to that website, which is a blogger site, and you'll notice there's a MyChingo application. You basically just click on the record button and start speaking. You can leave me a contribution of up to 2 minutes in length. Anyway, thanks for listening.